Welcome, everybody. Well, over the years, I've been enjoying working my way with you through this Book of Serenity, 100 Zen Stories. Slowly working our way through stories of our Chinese Zen lineage. And we're up to case 22, the 22nd story here. I thought we could look at a little bit tonight. Here it's called Yen Toes, Bow and Shout. And might as well just start right off with the story, just set the stage. The story goes like this. When Yen Tao came to Dushan, he straddled the threshold and asked, "Is this ordinary or is it holy?" Dushan immediately shouted, and Yen Tao bowed. The story goes on from there, but to keep it simple, let's leave it at that for now. Yen Tao was actually a student of Dushan, so this probably wasn't the first time they met. Student and teacher wanting to have an interaction, wanting to explore their understanding together, bring out their understanding, and maybe there were bystanders who wrote down the story. Somehow it got recorded. So Yen Tao straddled the threshold, and it doesn't really explain this here, but the way I imagine it is like the threshold of a door, like the Zendo has a little what do you call those things?
Threshold.
Door jam.
Door jam? Is it is the raised part the jam?
That's the door jam. That's the threshold of the door jams.
The jams are the things that come up.
Oh, really? Oh.
It's a threshold.
Threshold? There's probably like a, you know, architectural name for it.
No, that is the name of threshold.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Okay, a threshold. And for those who've been traveling in Asian Buddhist countries, most of the temples, especially in China and Japan, also Tibet, I think, they often have a big doorway into their Buddha hall. And the threshold of the doorway is often like really high, raised up. Like almost like to the scale is like the bigger the doorway, the higher the threshold. Sometimes almost like waist high. You have to kind of climb over if it's a big kind of two-story door. I once asked, I think, somebody over there, like, what's with these giant thresholds? And they explained it like it's part of their understanding in China, this was, I think, that like kind of ghost-like spirits, kind of like sort of demonic spirits and forces of delusion that you kind of don't want to let into the pure Buddha hall, they travel low. These spirits, they can't go so high up. They're like mist that moves along the ground. So if you build this threshold there, they bump into it and they can't get in. But people can walk over it.
Probably the chickens.
Maybe the chickens. Chickens and other demons. Yeah. Because, you know, I guess it wouldn't keep the mice out. They would just climb over. But it has this, also it makes you very conscious that you can't just like run right into the Buddha hall. You have to kind of stop and slow down. It kind of marks the separation from the outside, the rest of the world, we might say, and the sacred space of the Buddha hall, that when you enter it, you bow, and when you, like here, when we exit the sacred hall, we bow to honor the sacred space. So maybe we could understand the story like this: straddling the threshold is like step halfway in, you know, one foot in the sacred Buddha hall, the holy place, and one in the mundane world outside. I think we could hear it in different ways. Often these Zen stories are like that, but that's one way to hear it. We're halfway in and halfway out. And is this ordinary or holy? Is this person standing here with one foot in each world, is that person ordinary or holy? Is this situation ordinary or holy? Ordinary, or this Chinese character means like mundane, mediocre, common, ordinary. Mundane is an interesting word, right? Because it's related to monde, at least in French. Monde means world. So, of the world. And the world it's interesting that like the opposite of sacred or holy is related to the world from way back in Western religions, right? Yeah, heaven and earth, right? That there's something, maybe profane is kind of strong, but it's, the world is so ordinary. It's not necessarily the sacred space, the holy place in our language. And the world is the place where we live, where there's time moving along and space that we move through and 10,000 things. That's like the world. And holy, the English word holy, is related to the word whole etymologically. So the whole is where there aren't 10,000 things, or you could say the combination, all 10,000 things, one whole piece. Whereas the world is like the differentiated, piecemeal, scattered and confusing realm. It's just a little bit from these English words, mundane, the world of many things, and holy is the one whole, complete, nothing lacking. It's like whole. So these are Chinese terms, but in English they have those connotations. And we may think in terms of this duality of ordinary and holy, we may think about this some in our practice, consciously or unconsciously. And Zen is this tradition that emphasizes the ordinary within all the religions and spiritual practices in the world. Zen has kind of the reputation for celebrating the ordinary, maybe more than any other tradition. And also Zen is one of the most radical non-dual traditions. So I think that's maybe why the ordinary is celebrated, so as not to dualistically separate the ordinary from the holy. They're right there together. And yet at the same time we can, because we celebrate the ordinary so much, we might think, well, it's just, there's nothing, there really is nothing special or holy about this practice. Now, we could also extend this sacred and holy into concepts like enlightenment, great awakening, Now that sounds holy and extraordinary, doesn't it? Even if we don't even know what it means, it sounds that way. And I think that's implied in the teachings, right? Buddha was an ordinary person, and then he had this experience, the sutras say. Something completely changed him into a new person. We call enlightenment. Happened in a particular time and place, right? And he wasn't the same anymore. So that doesn't sound so ordinary. So what do we make of this, like, delusion and enlightenment, sentient beings and Buddhas, ordinary and holy? And even in Zen, we might say, well, everything is it, and our practice moment to moment is itself enlightenment. But I think it's very easy and dangerous to sell ourselves short then, right? And so we have, even in Soto Zen, which is even within Zen, the most ordinary, emphasizing the ordinary the most, we have stories like Keizan Zenji, a Dogen, our ancestor Dogen in Japan. His great-grandson in the Dharma is Keizan Zenji, considered like the co-founder of Soto Zen in Japan. And he often says stuff in his transmission of light that sounds like there's something other than just being ordinary about this practice. For example, he says, this realm of awakening, in order to get you to know this realm, spiritual teachers use unlimited means to get you to put an end to the six senses and stop everything. At such a time, there is something that cannot be destroyed, something that cannot be crushed. When you become aware of it, it surely cannot be reduced to emptiness or existence, nor is it bright or dark. Therefore, it's hard to talk about whether you're deluded or enlightened in this realm. It's kind of implied we're trying to reach this realm that's actually neither enlightenment nor delusion. We don't even want to call it Buddha, Dharma, mind, or essential nature. It's nothing but bright, clear luminosity, brilliantly shining. It's not the light of fire or the light of water. It's just boundless clarity and brightness. You cannot see it though you try. You cannot acquire it though you try. It's just clear awareness. When at the end of the eon, when the whole universe is destroyed by massive amounts of water, fire, and wind, it is not destroyed. When the three realms and the six paths of sentient beings arise again in a new world system, and the myriad things sprout profusely, this does not change. Even Buddhas can do nothing about it. Even the ancestors don't know what to make of it. Oh people, if you want to reach this realm in person, you must close your eyes for a while. Where the breath ends, forget your body. Have no place to lodge your body. Have no relationship or function in this world, like a cloudless blue sky, and become like the great ocean without waves. Then you'll have some experience of it. So Keizan sometimes talks like this. Doesn't sound so ordinary. But he also says, it's not the realm of enlightenment or delusion. it's a clear brightness, but it sounds like there's something to actually realize. Yeah. Dogen in his Bendawa says, although this inconceivable Dharma is abundant in each person, it's not actualized without practice, and it's not experienced without realization. All Buddhas continuously abide in it, but they don't leave traces of dualistic consciousness in their illumination. All sentient beings continuously move about in it, but illumination is not manifest in their dualistic consciousness. So there's distinctions being made. It's not all just the way our body and mind are usually working in the ordinary way. It doesn't sound like that, does it? And yet, how could it be separate from this? Not somewhere else. I think that's a danger when we talk about holy or sacred or extraordinary. Ordinary or holy? And how can we say which is which? Nagarjuna, one of the great Indian ancestors, sometimes called the second Buddha, because he just laid it out so explicitly how things are. He said, samsara, or the cycle of birth and death, the world, basically. Samsara is the painful, habitual, blind cycle of discontent. This samsara is itself nirvana. Nirvana, the perfect freedom from all discontent. That which is beyond the world. Even in Indian Buddhism, they use these terms like loka means world, actually, realm, or literally like world. And so worldly practices and dharmas are without the realization of reality. And then there's Lokutara, means beyond the world, or we could say mundane and transmundane, or supramundane. It sometimes gets translated Lokutara. So this is part of our tradition, right? There's a non-ordinary realm from the very beginning. And so Zen is a very radical tradition to emphasize the ordinariness. And maybe it's partly in response to people seeking for and trying to get some holy, special realm that's not here and now. It's maybe part of it, which is a mistake, but then the opposite's also a mistake, right? To think, well, then just, you know, I'm just sitting zazen, I'm kind of spaced out, and, you know, I'm thinking a lot, but at least I'm staying on the cushion. And doesn't Dogen say that, like, just to take this posture is itself enlightenment? Cool, I'll believe that. And then sign me up for that religion. I can just sit here in this posture and believe that that's so. And that might help us a little bit for a little while, but we might be actually able to convince ourselves conceptually, or have so much faith in what Dogen says, that that we could just convince ourselves that it's so. But in the back of our mind is maybe a little doubt, at least if it's brought up. Maybe we try not to bring it up. But really? Is that all there is to it? So it's maybe kind of a big issue, especially for long-term practitioners. If we're really giving our lives to this, how's it going? And I think a little trap in Soto Zen in particular, where we emphasize the ordinariness, is that practice does help us. Even if we haven't realized the supramundane, it helps anyway. Just to sit down and be quiet helps, right? So it's beneficial, and we might be drawn to it in that way. Like mindfulness-based stress reduction, right, is widely recognized to reduce stress. I think, and Zazen, even if we're kind of spaced out, or even if we're like quite present, but it's still quite ordinary, it's beneficial, it's helpful. So I think the danger is we can just leave it at that. Maybe the danger is not, maybe that's too big a word, right? Maybe that's too strong. That could be just wonderful, but I think the longer we do this practice and the more we give ourselves to it, I think then those doubts can arise more like, well, we're going to die soon. So before we die, is there actually this realm of total brightness that cannot be destroyed when the whole universe is destroyed? Does it seem important to realize this? Then, well, we gotta get it. It must be somewhere else. So if we avoid this dilemma of either trying to pretend it doesn't exist or graspingly seek it, either one of those, I think then we miss out. So Yanto straddled the threshold. One foot on each side. Is this ordinary or holy? Doshan immediately shouted. We can't say. The very conceptual idea of ordinary and holy is part of the problem in the first place. We could say holy, the whole, is when we don't make these distinctions between ordinary and holy. And the world is where we make the distinctions between ordinary and holy. So a shout is a pretty good answer. But it's easy for that to become just another, like a Zen cliche. What did Nagarjuna mean when he said that this cycle of suffering and bondage called samsara is itself actually nirvana? It's easy to, again, hear something like that and to say, sounds good. Partly it sounds good because it gets me off the hook of having to like realize this extremely subtle and mysterious realm called nirvana. Maybe this is it already. But I think if we hear statements like this without understanding what they're actually pointing to, then they're like, can become poison. This great, great elixir medicine of Nagarjuna can become poison. Well, so Dogen says, those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. Maybe that could apply to this story too. Those who have a kind of holy realization of the ordinary are Buddhas, those who have an ordinary take on the holy are deluded. So I think that there may be, just, you know, talking with people and studying a lot of Dharma over the years, and I think even within Zen, there is a sometimes subtle and sometimes not so subtle difference of view about this kind of thing. And the Zen schools actually are a little bit different too. Like my teacher Tenshin Roshi, his commentary on this case number 22, it's not exactly about the case. He rambles on for a while, but I thought this was interesting, and it's, I think, related in a way to this discussion. He's saying, he brings up this quote, well, I don't know where it's from, but like one of the old Chinese Zen quote that I'd never heard before myself, talking about these different schools, that there's these five houses of Zen, particularly there's Rinzai and Soto, the Linji school and the Saodong school. And Linji or Rinzai we might know as very dynamic, very like lively and kind of rough style. Even in modern America, Rinzai Zen centers are more that way. In the Linji school, this quote says, the realized ones realize it by headlong daring, and the confused ones lose it out of recklessness. That's a little like pointer about a way of like being on track and off track in the Linji style. Those who actually really realize it do so by headlong daring, some sort of like diving in, abandoning everything. But those who miss it, the confused ones, lose it out of recklessness. So recklessness sounds very close to headlong daring, doesn't it? We might ask, well, what's the difference? I think it may be quite subtle difference in the Linji school. Luckily, we're not the Linji school, so we don't have to worry about this too much. But I thought that was a nice pointer. There's something really helpful about headlong daring, and something not so helpful about recklessness. And they might look almost the same. Now, in the Soto school, this is our lineage. This quote says, "The wise ones realize it out of subtle insight or finely tuned insight, and the confused ones lose it out of involvement in minute details." Again, I think, great. It shows the difference of these two schools, and then it shows these two very similar expressions in the two schools. So our school is not so much about like crazy, headlong, daring. Maybe we have our moments, but we're more about like very careful, subtle, fine investigation into the subtle realm of reality. But we can lose it out of involvement in minute details. Maybe you could say like getting too caught up in the conceptual details. Or Soto Zen is known for like embodying the forms with great detail. And I think we can realize some subtlety about how things are in our careful attention to the forms of practice, but we can also lose it in like excessive involvement in the forms, for example. We can get nitpicky, yeah. That's the danger of Soto Zen. Rinzai Zen, they don't get so nitpicky, I think. It's a little sloppier, actually. So So, yeah, with that in mind, this ordinary and holy investigation, instead of just diving into ordinary or holy, we're more like, what exactly is going on here in this these two sides? Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. The great realization, actually, it's like the word Satori is in the Genjo Koan there. Those who have this great Satori, which we think of as more Rinzai Zen term, of like a sudden breakthrough. But we could maybe hear it in that way. Those who have a sudden breakthrough, Satori, about delusion are Buddhas. In other words, when we understand how deluded we are, that's like being Buddha. Instead of having some great break, those who have great realization, those who are greatly deluded, those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings, which means like all our conceptual ideas, realizations like this or like that, is ordinary sentient beings. But like we could say direct experience that delusion is delusion. We might even say, maybe I feel okay going so far as to say that everything we've ever thought and experienced, that's maybe really pushing it. Everything we've ever thought and experienced is delusion. And if we really realize that, then that's like being Buddha. We think, well, some of my experiences are pretty good. Maybe they're enlightened ones. But if it's a person having an experience, that's just another dualistic event. It's another ordinary event. But what about this realm that's brighter than the sun that can't be destroyed when the universe is destroyed? Is that an experience? Maybe not. An experience of a person having something happening to them. That's like duality and delusion. So Dogen's almost implying that having this great realization, this great Satori of delusion or about delusion, what delusion really is, that's being Buddha. Almost seeing the limitation of every experience. Or maybe we could also say, just seeing that every experience is just merely that, it's just an experience. Happening in this boundless space, and this boundless space is not an experience, right? If we can easily make it into one, I can kind of feel the boundless space that everything is happening in, the boundless space of awareness that contains all experiences and delusion and body and mind and the world, all of that is appearing in this boundless space. But is the boundless space an experience? It's tempting to try to make it into one. What if we call the boundless space the ungraspable, nameless, but temporarily named, you know, defiling it a little bit by naming it like this. If that's the holy, you could say it's never apart from us. The sacred, holy realm. We're always in it, the space. And the ordinary is everything that's appearing within the holy, so there's no separation between them. We could say samsara is what seems to be appearing within the big space of nirvana. Therefore, there's no separation between them. Samsara is actually made of nirvana in this way. It's not exactly how Nagarjuna says it, but we might understand it something like that. So what if this holy, ungraspable Buddha realm is not somewhere else? It's accessible every moment. Not only accessible, but it's like we can't escape it, actually. And we can't lose it, actually. I mean, if it can't be destroyed when the whole universe is destroyed, then little me definitely can't lose it, right? And little me and you, we could never destroy it or really even defile it in any way. We can't grasp it as something, and yet we can easily ignore it and just put all our attention on the appearances happening in it. It's called samsara, and therefore we're just, it's a mess. Our life is goes through waves of messiness and neatness, but even the neatness is pretty messy, actually, right? And we're just basically plummeting towards our impending death, and we have some good times and bad times along the way. Samsara is not all total misery, but it's not nirvana. Unless we see it for what it actually is. So maybe I should stop and see what you think about this investigation of ordinary and holy. Yes.
Well, you know, all we have really to use are our words, and they're very clumsy, and they're inaccurate. So, with that caveat,
yes,
I think, in my view, we can talk about having an experience. And again, it's not ultimate, because it's boundless, and we can't even talk about it. But this is all we have, is this crude approximation. So I'm thinking, you know, the experience that the direct, for example, you know, Avalokiteshvara in the Prajnaparamita, in my view, has a direct experience of interdependence, and that relieves, that's a liberative experience.
Non-conceptual direct. Understanding.
Clumsy little human lives. I mean, that's the only way I know how to talk about it. Because if it's always not an experience, then it's a fantasy, and it's not real. But we're positing that it is real. It is.
I guess it depends what we mean by experience. I think could be used in these different ways.
Yeah, and we could talk probably all night about it, and we could if you want. But I do want to kind of make a little stand for, you know, again, as we're awkwardly trying to figure it out, that maybe we could allow ourselves to think that there is some, because here's the thing, you know, when you said, this is when I thought this up, when you were talking about, you know, if you're just sitting zazen and you're just kind of la-di-da-di-da, right, and you think, well, this is all there is, you're just going to stay there, I was curious about, well, what might it feel like to open to, okay, this isn't all there is. What would you be opening to? Well, in a way, what you're opening to is some kind of experience that is something other than just sitting there going, oh, well, this is all there is, and I don't have to make any effort because Dougie said that delusion is enlightenment, so he cares about it. There's some, right?
Yeah.
There's some kind of a distinction. And not to make it too holy and too precious. And yet, when we have those experiences, we are transformed by them. And we see it in one another. When somebody's coming from a non-dual place, or is coming from their compassion, as contrasted with coming from, you know, who cares?
Yeah.
Feel it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's kind of
like, I'm reminded of, in the Gendo Koan of Dogen also, he says, when Dharma fills your whole body and mind, you understand that something's missing. But when Dharma doesn't fill your whole body and mind, you think it's already sufficient. So that could mean various things too, but we could apply it here too, is that the more we practice and understand, the deeper we want to go, and the more we see like there's much more to this. It unfolds more and more the more we get into it, as opposed to like, I finally got to the end, now that's it. Yeah. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand something's missing. And Dogen also says along the lines of this experience issue, in the Bendowa, he says, those who practice know whether realization is attained or not, just as those who drink water know whether it's hot or cold. So drinking water is, and knowing whether it's hot or cold, we definitely could say is an experience. And maybe that's where metaphor is somewhat limited. It is always limited metaphor. And, you know, I can say, this is cool water, but if someone had never experienced temperature before, which is hard to imagine, but then if you're trying to explain how cold water is different than hot water, no, it's really cold, it's like this, the person would be like, huh? It's like, it's, you know, hot is this little more like tingly, this burning sensation, like, what? But so we try in words, but we, in a way, we could have a direct experience of the coolness of water, but when we try to explain it to someone who doesn't know what temperature is, it just sounds crazy. Yes?
For me, it's like the idea of holy and unholy is kind of a trap of separation. If you treat, like in our practice, when we treat, like going through the door with our right foot on the right side, all that effort, attention and effort, that creates experience. The experience, I think, that we're talking about is holy. And then we can drop off the holy because everything becomes important to in our lives. And it has that kind of grounding effect, if you will. So there's nothing really holy in another sense, too, because everything's holy.
Yeah.
And so it becomes this extra thing. Mm-hmm. Rather than putting in the effort and the attention to everything, the ordinary, which is where everything is.
We start as a kind of like skillful means. We start making some things holy in order to pay more attention to them, like where you step through the door, in order to then start relating to everything in that way. Yeah.
It can become like OCD, but after a while, it's freeing. You know, it's freeing in its own effect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Treating certain things like in the Zendo, being especially careful because it's the holy place, but that's just a kind of made up thing so that we can get more used to it in a more focused way and then make everything that kind of holy.
Make everything the Zendo.
Yeah, make everything the Zendo, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Just as you were talking, it made me think about my profession, which I don't like to think about too much. But, you know, the great philosophers, social scientists of religion would say that we could get trapped into a discussion about distinguishing between the sacred and the profane. The language that they use is this worldly and
otherworldly.
And they are pretty consistent in always maintaining that all of this is language that we use to describe, to try to make sense of this world, even kind of bracketed this world. So who cares whether the holy exists or not? It doesn't really matter. It's the function that it serves in our lives, which some of the writers will say, well, this is about making meaning or trying to understand our lives as meaningful. And there are other people who say, this is really about how the great paradigms and like economics or sociology, they don't really understand suffering. So that's the function of the hope, is to help us deal with the suffering.
Yeah.
Buddhists, they're just kind of theorists.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Some of the theorists are actually China specialists, so, and India specialists. So, and the one person I'm thinking of is kind of comparative religions, but certainly, you know, you can see the traces of what they're saying in the early 20th century, going back to the 6th century.
Well, it definitely, it makes for long books and discussions to talk about these two sides and define them. And Buddhism, particularly Zen, also has its long books, right? But hopefully they're always pointing back to something like, we might say, experience, or you know, if there's an idea of the holy, it's not just to make a nice philosophy, but like to point to, is there truly liberation from suffering in a sustainable, stable kind of realization, and that's why it would matter. We could say if that's what it's a very practical function of, and so.
Using the philosophers, I'm thinking of, they raise this question: why am I sick? Why is my brother-in-law dying? Why it is?
Mm-hmm.
Why did so-and-so die at an early age? Some of these people, these are the great questions of this world or of this experience that all religions help us to think about.
Why we might not ever be able to truly answer, but how can we live with that? And is, you know, all these religions, is there this shift? That's what I was, maybe forgot to finish this idea, is that, like, I think within Zen, I think there's the maybe camp that believes it's not really about a shift of perspective, we might say. It's actually, and it's, in a way, that's a more non-dual perspective. It's always been here, it's already here, and it's not about some, you know, particular shift in time and space. And some would say, no, it's all about a shift of perspective. We have to find this shift and keep shifting. And I think that's an interesting discussion, especially in non-dual traditions. Because either fall into either extreme there could be a problem. Like, we gotta make this shift because it's not happening now. Or like, it's always happening, so there's no shift to make. Either way could be a problem, right? Yes, Richard.
I toss out without any real conviction or knowledge about the idea that what Nagarjuna is saying is that this is the perfect place to be, to learn, to experience, just given all the things that, you know, it's stunningly ugly, beauty, perfect, you know, place to be. But the thought about that comes to me about the suffering is that, given that this is just this stunning school for souls or beings to be involved in, will never change. It's perfect, and there will always be suffering. That's part of it, but you won't always be suffering. There will always be suffering as an integral part of this thing Nagarjuna was talking about. But it's the distinction between that. That suffering won't always be yours. It's just, I can't really go, I can't put that into a solidity, but it hits me in kind of a poignant way.
We could say, be sentient beings of the world are defined by believing that they are suffering. That's kind of the definition in Buddhism of a sentient being, is believe that they're a separate individual and therefore suffering just by being separate. And then Buddhas are those who see that that's an illusion, that there isn't really a such thing as a sentient being, although sentient beings appear, and therefore suffering appears. So as long as there's the belief in the world, the mundane, the ordinary, as real, that's the realm of samsara and suffering. And then if that same world of appearance is seen as merely an appearance, arising dependent on conditions, having no nature of its own, but just a dependent arising, then that's the very freedom. And it doesn't go away, it doesn't look any different, but it's a profound shift of perspective, we could say. And then one who realizes that is free from suffering, but the one, at least for that moment. Yeah. And, you know, our tradition has this irreversibility as part of the Buddhist story, is there can be the point of no return, which just means that you no longer will ever believe it again. All kinds of stuff will keep happening, but there's that possibility too. And that's really holy. Holy irreversibility. And it's awesome to contemplate as a mere mortal sentient being like myself, that as Dharma fills my practice more and more, the more I see like how much is totally missing. So gotta keep practicing. Ordinary or holy? Huh! Last question. Quick one.
The conjunction or ordinary or holy. As you've been talking, it has deconstructed itself into an and. But I don't think it's a minute detail to know if in the text that or is an or that sort of is stuck there, or if it can somehow flip itself into an and.
Yes. I think maybe that's what the shout actually converted the or into an and.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's a beautiful grammatical point there.
I would like to say a word for language. When used with precision, and an awareness of its beauty as well as its limitations.
Ordinary and holy, and maybe Nagarjuna would say, neither ordinary nor holy. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, and I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, and I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to be coming.